The Source Podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. The average American consumer consumes about 12 to 15 pounds of palm oil a year. It's in just about everything from peanut butter to ice cream to detergent to biodiesel. It is a miracle substance. And if money makes the world go round, palm oil greases the global gears. But with this worldwide rush to grow and produce palm oil in many of the world's most impoverished places, things are happening that you, the consumer, you probably should know about. That is, if you are an ethical consumer, how responsible are you for the sins committed to bring you that bar of chocolate or cup of coffee? Let's talk about being an ethical consumer, and let's start with palm oil. You can call in with your questions and comments. The number is 210-614-8980. Do you want to be an ethical consumer? Are you willing to pay a little bit more for products if you can be sure they're produced ethically? Again, the number is 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet at us at @tprsource. We're joined this afternoon with Paul Tullis. He's a long-form environmental journalist. He authored the piece, How the World Got Hooked on Palm Oil, that was published by The Guardian in February. Paul, welcome to The Source.
Hi, good to be with you.
Kimberly Carlson is with us. She is assistant professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Management at the University of Hawaii, Manoa. Kimberly?
Aloha. Good afternoon.
Aloha to you. And Jeff Abbott is a freelance journalist based in Guatemala. He wrote the piece for Al Jazeera in February, Palm Oil Industry Expansion Spurs Guatemala Indigenous Migration. Jeff, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me.
Kimberly, let me start off with you. If you could tell us, like, just briefly, what the heck is palm oil?
Yeah, so palm oil is, you might not know, have ever heard of it, but it's the leading edible oil in the world. So around 30 to 40% of all the oil that we consume as edible oil is palm oil. And it's grown only in the tropics. It's originally from West Africa. But these days, it's mainly produced in Indonesia and Malaysia.
And what makes it so attractive? I mean, there's lots of edible oils.
Yeah, so first of all, from a producer's standpoint, it's very high yielding. So you get 5 to 10 more times the calories from a hectare of palm oil than you might from something like soybean or rapeseed or sunflower. So that's great on the producing side. And then it's an extremely versatile oil. It can be used, obviously, for frying and cooking. But then various palm oil products can be used for things like soaps, shampoos, and even biofuels.
Paul, tell us, you wrote the piece, How the World Got Hooked on Palm Oil. So the world is hooked on palm oil, and is that a bad thing?
Well, it's a bad thing if you care about carbon emissions and if you care about biodiversity and extinction of animals. Deforestation, much of it for palm oil, is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in Indonesia, a nation of 261 million people. And it's contributing to, as I said, extinction of orangutans, Sumatran tigers and rhinos, and contributing a great deal to carbon emissions because jungles hold more carbon than plantations. So when jungles are cut down, their carbon is released, and they're no longer able to store carbon emitted from other sources, such as cars and coal-burning power plants. And as Kimberly was alluding to, much palm oil doesn't show up on labels as palm oil because it's processed and mixed in with other things. More than 200 food and home and personal care products, such as soaps and detergents, use palm oil, but only about 10% of them contain the word palm in their name. So it makes it very difficult for the conscious consumer to avoid palm oil and stem the deforestation.
Jeff Abbott, you're in Guatemala, and you've been covering what's happening there with human rights and politics in Central America. And your piece, Palm Oil Industry Expansion Spurs Guatemalan Indigenous Migration. So as we hear about Indonesia and other parts of the world, in Africa, where they are producing palm oil on a wide scale, this is also happening in Central America. And what's the impact there?
Yeah, so since the 1980s, palm oil production in Guatemala has expanded exponentially, around 270%, according to one Center for Rural Studies. As a result, it's further exacerbated the crisis of land in Guatemala, with indigenous communities being pressured to sell their land to palm oil companies for production. Sometimes this is done, directly with the company. Other times they're using intermediaries who say they're going to be producing other products. So as a result, the indigenous communities no longer have the means for sustaining. And as a result, they are forced to work on the palm plantations, and in the palm plantations, they receive very little wages, and they end up becoming forced to leave to find other opportunities.
So these are indigenous lands. These people have been living on these lands before Columbus, arrived in the New World, essentially, right?
Yeah, exactly. I
And they
mean,
don't even speak Spanish. They speak indigenous languages.
well, a lot of them are dual lingual. They can speak both Spanish and their indigenous language, primarily Quechua, Mam, Mayan. They're in the lower regions where palm oil expansion is occurring.
And in places like Honduras and Guatemala, the military is frequently involved in the dislocating people from this land, pushing them off the land, and allowing industrialists to come in and do slash and burn and put in palm oil plantations.
In 2011, the Guatemalan military and the Guatemalan National Police were involved in the eviction of nearly 800 families from the Poloquin Valley in Alta Verapaz. And this was done at the request for a company with ties to Nicaragua and the Guatemalan oligarchy. And the families were left basically on the side of the road without any means of survival. Around 200 families managed to negotiate some other lands and establish a community near where they were originally, but the majority remain in incredibly poor conditions.
And there's also been assassinations of people who've tried to organize these dislocated people.
Yes. Well, not just the dislocated people. There's been assassinations carried out here in Guatemala over the last 20 years. There's been hundreds of assassinations of activists, environmentalists, indigenous community leaders, etc. One in the situation with palm oil, the most notable is the assassination of Rigoberto Lima, who was a teacher from Sayache Petén in the north of Guatemala, who was assassinated in September 2015 after filing a lawsuit against a company, Repsa, which is owned by a powerful Guatemalan oligarch family. And the case, there's been two arrests in the case, but it's not advanced since then.
And so, as we experience this crisis on a border with people showing up from Guatemala and Honduras at numbers that exceed what we see from Mexico seeking asylum, frequently these are people who have been driven off their lands to build more palm oil plantations.
Yeah, of course. Especially recent, like in the last year, there's begun the migration of the Quechua Maya people, who
Wow.
historically haven't migrated.
So Paul, I'm definitely put you on hold right there. This is a complicated story to tell, and we're going to get into it. First, I got to take this break and remind people that our phone number is 210-614-8980. We're talking about palm oil, and we're talking about you as a consumer, and what's the connection between the two, and should you be aware of how this consumable got to your kitchen table? The number is 210-614-8980. The source continues right after this. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We live in a global economy, and the world is shrinking all the time when it comes to the shipping and the moving of cargo and parts and consumables. So we can get things on your kitchen table that was grown, they were grew. you know, half the world away. But how responsible are you for how it, what it took to grow that item and to move it to your local store and you can pick it up and you can buy it for essentially pretty cheap here in the United States? How does that work? And so when it comes to palm oil, it's in practically everything. All the, a lot of the toiletries that we have, processed food, it's just, it's something that it's just, it's in everything. You can't avoid it. And it's hard to, even if you tried. Why is that? How does palm oil, how did it become part of our lives? Is there a way that we can try to make sure that palm oil is produced in a ethical way? The number to call in is 210-614-8980. Let's get Barbara on the line. She's called in. Hey, Barbara, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to say that I almost find it unfathomable that people are not aware of the destruction caused by the palm oil production and the loss of habitat for the orangutans. And of course, you know, the environmentalists and the people who are being driven from their land. And then I want to say that it really is almost very difficult to purchase anything at the grocery store that does not contain palm oil. Even vegan food, like Earth Balance, for example, has palm oil. And it isn't necessary. And so the manufacturers are completely indifferent to the environmental cost and the ethics behind the production. And so as consumers, what we can do is boycott any product that contains palm oil, contact the corporations and tell them that we want an alternative. We do not want to be a part of the destruction of orangutan habitat and destruction of the environment. And so, first of all, of course, people need to be made aware of what is happening, and hopefully they are ethically conscious and will make a stand and just boycott.
Okay, Barbara, thank you for that. She brings up a lot of interesting points. I do want to pick up where we left off the conversation with Jeff Abbott. We'll get back to there, Jeff, as we talk about the political problems that palm oil production is causing in Central America. But I want to address Barbara's concerns right off the bat. So Kimberly Carlson is with the University of Hawaii, Manoa. And so I think that when we say ban palm oil or boycott palm oil, is that possible?
That's a great question. So the biggest consumer of palm oil is not the United States or even Europe, but actually Southeast Asia and Asia. So China, India, Bangladesh, Indonesia, and Malaysia. And so, you know, if we as consumers in the United States choose not to consume palm oil, it might have some effect, but all those people in Asia are still going to be consuming it. So I think in the bigger picture, at least as a percentage of the palm oil consumption, it doesn't matter hugely. But that second part of calling the companies and telling them what what we want is probably more effective, I would say. And personally, I study palm oil, and I have for about 10 years. I still consume it, but I try to consume palm oil that is probably at least certified sustainable, because I think it's not going away. And in some ways, I think there's a lot of space for working towards a goal together with these companies rather than just not playing in that space.
And Paul Tullis, and you write how the world got hooked on palm oil, and the world got hooked on palm oil is because it solves a lot of problems. So if we were to suddenly say no more palm oil, then we would have to switch to other products that would be more difficult to produce and would take up more resources and wouldn't be as effective. So that may not be a good idea.
Yeah, as Professor Carlson said earlier, palm oil is one of the most high yielding of the vegetable, or it is the most high yielding of the vegetable oils. So if you're not using it, if you're replacing it with something else, then that could likely drive more deforestation to open up lands to produce its substitutes, soybean, cottonseed oil, such things like that. And also, if I could just speak to the question of banning or boycotting palm oil. You know, I spoke to people who were closely involved in conservation in Indonesia and Malaysia, such as the head of the Orangutan Land Trust, and they actually oppose boycotting palm oil. And the reason for that is, as Professor Carlson said, a lot of it is going to continue to be used anyway in other countries where, you know, consumer consciousness isn't really a thing. And also it would drive producers, smallholding producers, which produce about 40% of palm oil in some of these countries, it would discourage them from adopting sustainability standards. They would figure, well, you know, we're being pressured to adopt these very complex and expensive sustainability standards, but if people are just going to boycott palm oil anyway, then what's the point? And you know, palm oil is going to continue to be used in the nations that use it the most. And so what they're saying that what we need to be doing is as Professor Carlson said, purchasing sustainable, certified sustainable palm oil, although environmental groups have raised questions about how real that sustainability is.
Because it's a complex global market.
It's the most complex and longest supply chain of any food product. And that gets to the issue that Jeff was talking about regarding, you know, how workers and landowners are compensated. You know, all of the value of palm oil happens when it's processed and refined. Very little of it happens on the farm. So these people aren't getting compensated well. The government has very little reach in remote areas of Indonesia and Malaysia. The people don't have title to their land oftentimes. You know, they just know that, like, you know, family X has been farming that plot for decades, and so that's their land. But they don't have an official title, so it's easy for companies to move in and take over.
Right. But I really did appreciate Barbara's call saying, you know, raise awareness. Her answer was boycott, ban palm oil, and our response to that, or your response to that, is it's more complicated than that, and we have to find a very nuanced position in order to try and figure out a way to do arrive at the most benefit that we have from palm oil, which is a good substance. There's nothing wrong with the substance, apparently, but figuring out a way to do the least amount of harm in producing it. Is that where we are, Professor Carlson?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And there's some interesting things about the supply chain for palm oil that tends to ensure that the product is concentrated sort of in these large companies, these large multinational companies. So that's one issue. But I agree. I mean, it's an amazing product, and in some ways, it's a perennial. So it grows for like 25 years. It can be harvested every couple weeks, and so there's certain properties of that system that make it less environmentally damaging than like an annual crop where you have to be tilling and replanting every year. But in terms of the sustainability side of things, it's difficult to, I think, when you're in the field, to even understand what sustainability looks like. So there's in the palm oil industry, they're going through a process of defining what that is. And then ensuring that those standards are met is also very difficult. So today, around 20% of all the palm oil that it's produced is actually produced under the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil Certification Standard. But as referenced before, there's some questions about whether that is truly sustainable or not.
I'm going to go back to Jeff Abbott, and he's a journalist in Guatemala. He's been covering the human rights and politics there in Central America, and how he's written about how the palm oil drive has resulted in human rights abuses and throwing people off their indigenous lands, and how that is these folks are showing up on our border seeking asylum. Most of that story is not really being told very well. As we talk about the asylum seekers here in the United States, we frequently focus on the gang violence and other lack of justice issues in Central America. You think that's changing? You think people will start paying more attention to this part of the story?
Maybe. I mean, the reality is, like, the reasons for people, like the reasons why people migrate to the United States are a lot more complex than just the narrative of gang violence. At least in Guatemala. Guatemala has a long history of migration to the United States. And I think the more that people begin to analyze exactly why people are going, where they're coming from, it will begin to change the analysis of why people are leaving. I was going to mention earlier that the Kekchi Maya historically haven't migrated to the United States. A few have gone over the years, but the vast majority have gone either deeper into the jungles or into the Paten and, you know, set up their plots there. But within the last years, when we've actually begun to see the massive migration of people from the Kekchi Mayan territory in basically, like, if you go central Guatemala to the east. And talking with the mayor of Rashuja, where the municipality where Jacqueline Cal, the young girl who died in border patrol protection or custody in December is from, the mayor commented that within the last 3 months, people have begun to migrate massively towards the United States in order to seek an opportunity to sustain their families here.
But we're seeing that there is a big link between the military and the industrialist and the political leaders of these countries and dislocating people from their ancestral lands, which are in these old growth forest and jungles. That's very, you know, I think people would pay attention to that if they heard that story.
Yeah, the thing is that it's the same story that occurred in the 1980s during Guatemala's internal armed conflict. There was the genocide against the Mayan people carried out by Lucas Garcia, the dictator Lucas Garcia, and Efrain Rios Montt. And it's just this long history of displacement of the Mayan people. There's intense discrimination against indigenous peoples here in Guatemala, whether they be Mayan, Xinka, Garifuna. And it's just continued from one government to the next, and they keep following the same policies. And the government has shown time and time again that it's willing to utilize the military to intervene in social conflicts. In 2012, the government of Otto Perez Molina deployed the military to put down a protest in Totonicapan, and there were around 8 people killed on the highway by the soldiers. It's one of the first major massacres in the 20 years after the signing of the peace accords. So this relationship between the ruling elite, the Spanish descendants, and the indigenous populations continues now 500 years after the invasion of Guatemala by the Spanish.
I'm going to read an email from Chelsea. I was surprised to see products on the shelves at Sprouts that contain palm oil. Conscious consumers like myself assume that natural grocery stores choose the right products for us. Lessons learned when double-checking labels. How and where can I shop for more consciously for products? Ethical sourcing. Is there a particular website? As a consumer, I don't mind spending more to take care of Mother Earth. Any ideas, anyone? What do you do?
Go ahead.
That's, yeah.
Yeah. It's a difficult question. I think that with palm oil, probably the most, I would say the most sort of sustainable is Rainforest Alliance certified. They have the highest stringency in their standards. So if you see that little, the frog, the Rainforest Alliance frog on the product, you're probably pretty good to go. But it's in everything, like the peanut butter. If you don't want to stir your peanut butter, there's usually palm oil in there. So you can also go to the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil website. They do publish a lot of their supply chain members. And then there are some other websites that will kind of list companies and whether they're sort of good actors or bad actors.
Okay. But it's interesting that Chelsea is willing to spend a little bit more for products to take care of Mother Earth. She wants to be an ethical consumer. Is she an outlier, or do most consumers want to do that? Or if we want to feel confident, we're not willing to pay just a little bit more in order to feel better about what we consume. Does this describe you? Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980. Be an ethical consumer or not. 210-614-8980. The source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about palm oil. The number to call is 210-614-8980. This widely traded commodity in the global economy is in everything that we pretty much consume. But when you consume it, are your hands dirty? Because a lot of things happen. Labor, human rights, all sorts of problems occur in the production of palm oil in some locations. 210-614-8980. Beth is on the phone. Hey, Beth, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I was curious if anyone on the panel is familiar with C16. My daughter has a startup company, and she is brewing synthetic palm oil to replace palm oil. It's an exciting process. Her company's out of Boston. It's just got started this last summer, and they are in the process of trying to create the synthetic palm oil to replace palm oil.
Beth, thank you for the call. Kimberly Carlson, professor at the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Management at University of Hawaii, Manoa. Is synthetic palm oil an alternative?
I've never heard of synthetic palm oil before. That's an interesting idea. I imagine it would depend on what the source of the products that are being converted to palm oil are. So is it oil from the ground, or is it some other bio-based product? I don't know. But given the amount of palm oil that we produce globally, it would have to be a huge.
Yeah, the scale is one issue. And then Paul Tullis, environmental journalist, and he wrote the piece, How the World Got Hooked on Palm Oil, published by The Guardian. There have been other oils, edible oils, used in the past, and we have found out that not all of them were healthy.
Yeah, that's right. Basically, what happened is we found that butter was causing heart disease back in the 60s and 70s, and so food manufacturers looked for a replacement. And the only thing they could use that had the same properties as butter, a pleasing mouthfeel and the ability to stay semi-solid at room temperature, which you need for especially for baked goods, was partially hydrogenated oils. But then it was found that partially hydrogenated oils produce something called trans fats, which were even worse for the heart than butter was. So then they needed to look for a replacement for trans fats, and palm oil was really the only thing that had the same properties as butter and trans fats and could be dropped in as a replacement to all these different uses in foods that was available. Cottonseed and soybean oils, those were the ones that were getting hydrogenated because they didn't have those properties. But palm oil had a similar fat profile to hydrogenated oil and to butter, and so it became the substitute beginning in the 90s, and now it's just everywhere. And one reason that they have not looked for another substitute or tried to develop one like your caller's relative is doing is because it's cheap. And I would imagine that the challenge for synthetic palm oil would be to produce it at a competitive price. People, and this gets back to the conscious consumer question, people just haven't been willing to pay extra for a little bit of extra for sustainable certified palm oil. In fact, most of the palm oil that is certified as sustainable isn't even sold as sustainable because there's so little demand. The stuff is literally piling up in Malaysia and Indonesia. They can't get rid of it as certified sustainable because consumers aren't demanding it. And so it just gets poured in with the unsustainable stuff and sold as regular palm oil.
Let's go back to the phones with Barbara D. Barbara D., welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Sustainable or not, it's still taking away a lot of land that is desperately needed as we lose one species after another after another. I don't care just about the orangutan. I care about the rhinoceros and all the billions of insects we're losing and invertebrates. God only knows. The other thing is you don't have to use oil at all. I use olive oil for my salad. You can buy peanut butter. Organic peanut butter, Walmart brand, is great. Just pour the oil off. And as far as buying a whole bunch of stuff, you don't need to do that. We're over-consuming. Stop consuming so damn much.
I don't use oil, period.
All right, Barbara D., not everyone is aware and willing to put in the extra effort that you are. I want to get to the issue of biodiesel. This is something that they're using palm oil in the EU, the Europe, for that. And that's a complicated issue. How is that working out, Paul? Tell us.
Well, not quite as planned is the short answer.
Unforeseen basically, consequences.
Yeah, exactly. The for the first time in human history, a decision to try to do something good ended up backfiring with that. So what was happening was the European Union and the United States, they wanted to reduce the carbon impact of their transport fuels, i.e. gasoline and diesel. And so they said, well, vegetable oils would be better because some preliminary studies indicated that, you know, depending on how you measured it, that is basically without measuring the deforestation impact, the emissions of biodiesel from palm oil, soybean, et cetera, was less than it was from fossil fuels. But then they did what's called life cycle and found that that, you know, when you factor in the deforestation that's occurring, it's actually worse. And so they're now in the EU they're trying to remove the palm oil from biodiesel, although they've exempted smallholders from that is small farmers rather than the big corporate plantations from those restrictions, and they produce 40% of the palm oil from those countries. So, you know, the thing with life cycle emissions and land use change is, you know, you have to take the entire supply into account, or you're really not going to have much effect. So the new restrictions on biodiesel from palm oil in Europe are being criticized as likely ineffectual.
The number is 210-614-8980 as we talk about palm oil and its impact on the environment and migration. Jim is on the line. Jim, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Well, thank you. I think there's ample evidence now that where community and indigenous people's customary and traditional land rights are respected, that they're able to stave off mining palm oil companies, and also they do a much better job of conservation of forest and habitat. So one thing that people can do really is to support any policies and actions which push companies and governments towards recognition of customary and traditional land rights. And in Indonesia, this is also proving to be the case with the new laws there on recognition of customary land rights of forest-dwelling people. So that's one good thing you can support, and there are a lot of people working on this internationally.
All right, Jim, thank you for that. Jeff Abbott, who's a freelance journalist based in Guatemala, he's been covering what's happening with human rights and politics there. So American foreign policy plays a lot on what's going on in places like Guatemala and Honduras when it comes to what's happening there. What's your take?
So there are international conventions that protect the rights of indigenous peoples to the use of their lands and recognizing their stewardship of the land. Here in Guatemala, there was a study done a couple years ago that found that indigenous communities actually have the highest forest cover in the country, with the Sutajiles Mayas of around Lake Atitlan, which is a really popular tourist destination, having some of the highest levels of forest cover. The problem is it requires the government comply with those accords. Added to that, here in Guatemala, there are constitutional rights for indigenous peoples, for their forms of governance, for their identities. There was a convention signed in the peace accords in 1995 that recognized Guatemala as a plural national country. The problem is the governments have time and time again failed to comply with these accords. Recently, the Guatemalan government has come under fire by the Axil Maya communities for failing to consult the communities over the construction of a electric electrical towers in their territory. And the government had previously complied that they were going to consult them, and they built them anyway.
But sure, I want to get to this point, though, but you know, as American voters and as we should be concerned about what American foreign policy is. And are our foreign policies making this situation worse for indigenous people in these areas, or can we pressure our own government, or wherever we get around to a government change here, try and get a government that will be more responsible and can care about human rights?
Yes and no. The Trump administration has turned a blind eye to everything occurring in Guatemala.
But so has previous administrations.
Within this current administration, the Trump administration has shown time and time again that it's unwilling to fully interact with what is occurring here. But there have been attempts made by congressional Democrats to improve the situation in Guatemala recently with the cut of military aid. But other than that, it continues.
All right. When we come back, we're going to talk about the climate change part of the story and also about poverty. One of the big lines of narratives that we're hearing from the people who are pushing palm oil in these parts of the world is that this is a solution for poverty. But is it really? The number to call in is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. We're talking about you and palm oil. There is a connection. Are you ethically responsible for what it takes in order to bring you these delicious items to your table? The number is 210-614-8980. The Source continues right after this. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about palm oil today, and that is the substance that's in your peanut butter, it's in your detergent, it's in your ice cream. It's in everything, pretty much. Why is that, and what did it cost to bring it to you? So I'm going to Kimberly Carlson, assistant professor at the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Management, University of Hawaii, Manoa. So, poverty. Is palm oil making these areas more impoverished, or is it helping people?
That's a good question, and I think it's actually something that is hugely context dependent. So there are studies that show that palm oil is beneficial to people in terms of their household incomes. There are other studies that show that it actually, under certain conditions, can lead people into poverty. And it has to do with your starting condition. So in Indonesia, at least, there are people that are well set up to take advantage of the new industry coming into their lands, right? So suddenly they have a new market, they have some land, they can plant some palm oil trees. In other cases, perhaps the palm oil company has basically taken their land and they don't have any options. They end up working for the company, as we've seen in Guatemala, and those wages aren't very high. So I think that, yeah, it really depends on the context in which development occurs.
And Paul Tullis, I'd like to hear your take.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And as we were saying before, the problem is that it has such a long supply chain, and the value of palm oil that we pay when we buy a bottle of shampoo or a can of peanut butter, not a lot of that trickles down to the farmer. And the reason for that is it's heavily processed and refined. So the farmer sells their fruit to a mill, the mill processes it, it's refined further, it's fractionated, that is, separated out into oils of different consistencies for different uses, and then it's mixed in with other ingredients, and then it gets into a consumer product. So at every step of that chain, at every stage along the way, it acquires a little bit of value, and even at the end of the chain, it's the cheapest vegetable oil there is. So it's very little of what we're spending at the store is getting to the people who are actually growing the stuff.
We never really describe, how it grows. I mean, it is like a palm tree. And at the very top of it, it produces this I guess like the size of a basketball, a bunch of smaller fruits. And they're able to create one of these things like three or four harvests, five harvests a year, Kimberly?
Actually, you can, for a high yielding plantation, so one of these big industrial plantations, they harvest it every 2 weeks. So you're looking at maybe 100 harvests.
Does it take a lot of water and a lot of fertilizer?
In terms of water, it's actually not irrigated, so it's rain-fed. For most, the vast majority of palm oil that's grown is rain-fed, and so they only grow it in places that have really high rainfall. Fertilizer application rates are, I think, not very high in comparison to some of the other major oil seeds. So in terms of inputs, it's not a very intensive crop in that sense.
Why? And so it grows in these areas in a tropical zone. What is it about that zone that attracts it? It grows in terrible conditions, soil that usually wouldn't grow much at all, right?
Yeah, so it can grow in poor tropical soils. But it evolved in sort of Western Africa, in the very, very wet regions in that area. And so the places that we see it be most productive are really high sunlight, high water input regions. If it's given a lot of sun and a lot of water, it can produce a substantial amount of calories per hectare. In places that have sort of seasonal droughts, and this is actually an interesting question with increasing climate change, as climate shifts and water availability shifts, it could be that some of the most productive oil palm regions today might become less productive in the future.
So let's
because of the dependence on water, yeah.
Yeah, so let's talk about the climate change problem. Paul, tell us, how does palm oil plug into the calculus of climate change?
Right. Well, as Professor Carlson was saying, it grows in these tropical belts because of temperature and high rainfall. Those are also some of the most carbon-rich and biodiverse areas in the world. And so carbon is being stored by these forests. As you drive your car around, it emits carbon. That carbon floats around the atmosphere, and some of it gets sucked up by these jungles. So they're sequestering carbon. They're holding it for us. And then when we cut it down to grow a palm oil plantation, that sequestration ceases, and also the carbon that is stored gets released because the plant dies. Deforestation is the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in Indonesia, a country of 260 million people.
And Jeff Abbott with Central America, as you cover the issues there, we're seeing deforestation and the creation of large-scale palm oil farms.
Yeah, there is massive deforestation occurring in some of the oldest jungles in Guatemala occurring right now up in the Petén, where they're just cutting down massive tracts of forest to sow palm oil. Added to that, there are accusations against palm oil companies for the theft of rivers during the dry season, where they'll build a dam and channel the water into the plantation in order to irrigate the crops. Added to that, there's also the threat of contamination caused by the palm plantations, which occurred in 2015 with the death of millions of fish in the Rio Pasión in Petén, in Saiche Petén. So it's really contributing to these problems related to climate change that communities face.
Kimberly Carlson, where are we with the global trend on palm oil? Have we peaked with the consumer?
With growing population and growing wealth, I think that projection suggests that unless something changes, we're going to be demanding a lot more edible oil, say, in the next 50 years. So as people in China and Africa and Asia get richer, they not only consume more, but they consume more edible oils. And so because of that demand, I think that palm oil demand is just going to grow over time. And I also wanted to add, I know we're talking about climate for a second there, that it's not just the above ground biomass in Indonesia and Southeast Asia that's critical. Those areas have these extensive peatlands, which are below ground carbon that is built up over hundreds of thousands of years. And so that actually, in terms of oil palm's climate footprint, becomes an incredibly important source of emissions to the atmosphere too. As we drain those peatlands, all that carbon is emitted to the atmosphere. So it makes it worse in some cases than another part of the world where you might not have those organic soils.
So can we squeeze more palm oil out of the planet, Kimberly? I mean, where would that go? Where would that come from?
Great question. So a lot of the projections suggest actually South America is going to be one of the locations for palm oil expansion, as well as Africa. So there's a lot of fear. In fact, in South America, it seems that oil palm is clearing pastures, which aren't very carbon dense. So from a climate perspective, the South American trajectory might be sort of acceptable. But in Africa, it looks like palm oil would be expanding into, again, these dense, biodiverse tropical forests. And that would be, from a environmental perspective, a very damaging trajectory.
Can we squeeze more palm oil out of palm oil that exists now? Can genetically modified crops be introduced that would actually be more productive?
So a palm oil isn't a GM crop. It hasn't been genetically modified in that sense. But there's a huge, I think that the sort of the research plots that are at the highest yields in terms of breeding and all of that are, I think, twice what we're seeing on average, even from our industrial plantations. So there is a lot of, potential for increasing yields on oil palm lands.
And maybe creating palm oil breeds that would be able to use land that is now not being used for, that is not forest and is not high producing farmland. Is that possible?
Yeah. I think that even today we have certainly the plant doesn't particularly care what was on that land before it was planted. So I think that there is a lot of potential for guiding, creating policies at the company and government level that support expansion into areas that not only don't have forests and high biodiversity, but also don't necessarily have community land claims or provide communities with the ability to negotiate those land claims in a fair and informed way.
And Paul, tell us, the environmental journalist, do you think that there's something's going to change, that there will be a switch that will be flipped with American consumers and they will start demanding more responsibly produced palm oil, and that will make a difference?
Well, people need to get the word out, and people need to become aware of what they're using. An earlier caller said she doesn't use any oils, and if she's using any soap, if she's using any shampoo, any cosmetics, she's definitely using oils and probably palm oil, almost certainly palm oil. What they are doing, researchers are they've sequenced the entire palm oil genome, and so what they're able to do now is see the traits of high yield express themselves earlier before it starts producing fruit. So, when the plant is only knee high, they can say, this is one of the high yielding ones, let's plant that one. So they're hoping that they can double the yield of palm producing trees through this method, but that's still not expected to keep up with the expected quadrupling in demand over the next couple of decades.
This is an environmental journalist. His piece is How the World Got Hooked on Palm Oil. We have a link to that on our website. It was published by The Guardian in February. Kimberly Carlson is assistant professor at the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Management, the University of Hawaii, Manoa. And Jeff Abbott, he's an outstanding freelance journalist based in Guatemala, covering social movements there. We have a link to his story on our website. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.